Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more. And today we've got a great book. I'm really excited about this book. This book presses a lot of our buttons. You know, one of the things that we always like to talk about in these interviews is that this music is not disembodied. You know, we hear it on records or CDs or on the radio or on a streaming service, but it's coming from a flesh and blood human being that did things to make, to bring this music into being. And we, the more we know, in my opinion, the more we know about that story, the better. The other thing that we like to focus on always is scenes. In other words, there is no musician that grew up on a desert island and figured it all out by themselves. There's always tremendous interaction, and whenever you find a great musician, you'll always find there was a great scene from which that musician emerged. And then the third topic we love to talk about, and it's covered in this book as well, is the overriding importance of making sure that children have an opportunity to learn music. It is so important. And we're going to talk about some of these themes, but also about this remarkable musician, William Parker. So our guest today is Cisco Bradley. And he wrote a really, this is a great book, guys. It's called Universal Tonality, The Life and Music of William Parker. So welcome, Cisco.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit just about your background and then also how you came to decide to dedicate significant effort to documenting William Parker's career to this point?
Yeah, I'm a scholar of social and cultural history at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York, and I began there in 2011. And I'd lived in New York before, but you know, moving back to the city, I was really excited to kind of to connect with the music scene, and I kind of dove in headfirst and began going to tons of concerts from right from the beginning. And, getting more involved in music, doing lots of interviews with people, a lot of different musicians. I've had a longstanding interest in the music, going back, 20 years or so. And, William Parker was one of the people that I think kind of opened me up to what was happening in New York right now. And like many listeners, I imagine, I think it's easy to connect with people like John Coltrane or Miles Davis or Charles Mingus or all of these sort of legendary figures. And I for a long time, in a way, jazz was a history or it was a music of the past in my mind. And then I remember there was a record store owner who said, "Hey, maybe you should check out William Parker. He's doing some interesting stuff." And I thought, "Oh, okay." I started listening to his music, and I began with his quartet record, Sound Unity. So, and then explored a lot of his other music. And it's not that I was completely unaware of what was happening in New York, because I was living in Madison, Wisconsin as a graduate student at the time. It's just that I don't think I understood the full breadth and depth of what was happening in New York and in other places, Chicago and many other cities that have great scenes. And so for me, it was just a massive discovery of on a personal level of of the music that was happening, and William Parker was one of the big figures for me in terms of kind of connecting with the contemporary, free jazz scene. So to me, that was just completely sort of life-changing in a way. And I never thought, back then when I was first listening, that I would be, writing his biography, a number of years later. It just, these things all kind of lined up. I was fortunate to be able to move to New York in 2011. And from that point on, I began doing lots of research about different aspects of the music scene. This is one of the major ones. It's been a lifetime of exploration of the music and something that I feel like I can engage with my scholarship and the writing that I do.
Well, it really is, for when people get this, it's so wonderfully detailed. For one of the things Cisco has, for example, are maps, which I think every book that talks about history and society should have maps in it so that we know where exactly you're talking about. And I think there's at least three maps where you show the clubs in the Bronx, which is I've actually never seen anybody do that. Take the clubs and also I think the lofts too, the downtown lofts where they were, it just helps make the whole scene more vivid. And we've been talking about a scene, and maybe we should specify we're talking about the free jazz movement, also known as avant-garde. I was fascinated to hear that young William Parker actually heard Ornette Coleman's free jazz album more or less when it came out. That must have been, he was pretty young guy when he heard it, I'm guessing, right? 1960.
Yeah. I think he probably heard it around maybe 62 or something when he was about 10 years old. I'm guessing. I don't know exactly, but
it just shows that, that's clearly a different generation of musician. To have grown up literally being aware of that landmark album. And so I should know this off the top of my head. I'm sure you do. What year was William Parker born?
He was born in the Bronx in January of 1952. So he grew up there when there was still a jazz scene in the Bronx. There was a local jazz scene that his father, I think, was interested in, and his father was also very interested in collecting records, and so he kind of grew up, I think, with both of those kind of influences. So like a lot of neighborhoods in those times, there were active jazz clubs, and certainly in the South Bronx there was a an active scene there right up into the 70s before the economic kind of fallout prevented it from continuing. So when he was there, it was quite a vibrant scene, I think.
And one of his father's heroes was Duke Ellington, who was a hero to so many people for what he accomplished, not only with the music but also socially, to elevate the jazz orchestra to a high point. So William grew up hearing that at home, living amongst an active, living jazz scene in the Bronx, but then also as a kid hearing Ornette Coleman and colleagues playing free jazz. There's another thing about the Bronx that I'm actually a Bronx person. My grandparents and parents live there, and I actually lived there for a while too. And something I always like to tell people is it was that Cross Bronx Expressway that was such a devastation to the Bronx. That is actually, believe it or not, somebody once explained this to me, and I it was sort of revelatory. They said in the old days there was no such thing as South Bronx. There was, we talked about the East Bronx and the West Bronx, and it was the imposition of that superhighway. And for folks that don't know the region, it is literally a massive, heavily trafficked superhighway, elevated, that cuts right through and over what is now called the South Bronx. And it rains. And I think we just, since we have this opportunity to say it, it rains, diesel fumes and all kinds of toxins down on the people of that neighborhood. And it turned what was once, from what I understand from the old timers, a very beautiful neighborhood. In fact, William's parents, it was a step up, moving from, maybe the crowded conditions of Manhattan to a larger apartment in the Bronx. And then all that got devastated. So in addition to, having a father that loved music and living in a lively jazz scene and hearing Ornette Coleman at 10, he also experienced a catastrophe, an economic and social catastrophe caused by that infrastructure thing. So it's just more, and I think it's important to know that this is what William Parker grew out of, this amazing confluence.
Activity. It's incredible the sort of the forces that converged, kind of coalesced all at once to kind of destroy the South Bronx. And it became, I think, the poorest congressional district in the United States. That didn't happen by accident. There were definitely reasons why that happened. And, all the things that went along with it, like you said, the destruction of the community, making that community a place that people didn't really want to live. So, it also led to generally white flight out of those communities, and then you ended up with, the poorest congressional district in the U.S. That was, almost entirely people of color, and really devastated things. And I think, trying to understand where did William Parker come from, this was an important component. And I tried to illustrate that in the book as clearly as possible, with a lot of stories and so forth that William managed to weave into it.
One of the things that he experienced and that I experienced too firsthand was there were fires every day of the week, and sometimes multiple fires. In fact, there was a famous occasion where there was a Yankees baseball game, and the smoke, it was being televised, and the smoke was wafting into the stadium, and the commentator said, "Yeah, the Bronx is burning," and that's really what's going on.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of dedication, there was one thing that I want to share with everybody in the book, and I think it speaks so much to William Parker's character and his nature. As a young guy, he used to strap his bass. We're not talking about a bass guitar. We're talking about a full upright bass to his back, and walk all the way from the South Bronx to the East Village to gig, and then walk all the way back home. That blew my mind. I'm so glad you captured that piece of information for all of us.
I think he just had a real determination to do what he was going to do. He said, that he considered a number of things, I think, in his sort of youth about where he might, what direction he might go with in terms of work and so forth. But he said once he committed to music, it was like everything for him. So,
and one of the things that helped him, that helped him, and it was a pleasant surprise. Shouldn't have been surprised, but that in 1970 as a kid, he went to, I guess, a public library concert that featured Charlie Haden.
Yeah. I think he considers Charlie Haden to be an early inspiration and influence. He approached Charlie Haden and asked him, he just told him that he wanted to play music, he wanted to play bass. And Charlie told him to listen to records and play along with him as one way to kind of learn. And he kind of recounted that story to me several times. I think it left quite an imprint on him.
And he in fact did that. Let's talk about his early education as a musician. If I understand correctly, he didn't really have the formal education. He basically got the bass, tuned it up, listened to records, and went at it for hours and hours and hours and hours every day.
Yeah, he had a few. He had a few free lessons at Jazz Mobile, the school in Harlem. Run by Billy Taylor. But I think he got some of his early education there.
He studied with Richard Davis there a little bit. But, you know, I think by and large, William Park is pretty, as these things go, he's pretty self-taught. I mean, he had a few lessons there. But he really, the kind of music he wanted to play, they didn't really teach at the Jazzmobile. So, you know, I think he realized pretty early on that he would have to teach himself. And so, yeah, I do tell the story in the book about how he acquired his first bass from a pawn shop. And I think it took him, you know, something like 8 months to pay it off. And it was $100, I think. And so he saved up money and he said he'd go in every week or two or whatever and put down a couple dollars here and there. And, eventually he was able to get his bass. And yeah, from that point on, he started gigging fairly soon, actually, you know, in the local jazz scene. And, you know, began making connections with people, you know. So, yeah, playing along to records and teaching himself how to play. And he'd been listening to records all his life, so I think he had some base to work from. But, yeah, I think mostly self-taught.
There's a really interesting detail about that bass, and again, I'm so glad you captured all this, because to me it's so important to know the details of how a musician comes into being and all the helps along the way, and I think it's important because we have to be more conscious about helping the young generation. You know, we can't just, you know, leave it up to chance. And one of the things you talked about was the pawn shop owner, who I'm guessing he was an Eastern European person or I'm not sure what his background was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so he had this shop, and then there was this massive, which I actually remember as a 7-year-old, there was, I think I have the date right, there was a massive blackout and resulting riot and looting, where there was a lot of things got burned down. And many people left the Bronx after that. And this man decided he was going to stick with the community. And, mm-hmm. you know, what if he hadn't? You know, how would William Parker have gotten his bass? You know, it's just these little points of determination are so key. The other thing I want to point out to everybody is, you know, the New York Public Library had a concert with Charlie Hayden in the Bronx. I mean, that was such an that's an important thing to have done then. It would be an important thing now to continue to have high-level music for the community. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is all praise to the Jazzmobile, which is a great institution. I hope it's still around. I'm not sure. Maybe it's not.
Absolutely. I believe it is. Yeah.
Is it still around? Mm-hmm. It is? Oh, great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, it's you know, this infrastructure that existed to help the new generation come along and learn the music. There was another great detail that you captured, and I hope I'm not giving away too much of the book. The book everybody's got a lot more than these small details. There's another beautiful detail in there, and this is something that only somebody who grew up in the pre-CD, pre-streaming music environment can appreciate. So William said, we didn't have a lot of records, and my family didn't either. I think we had like 8 records total. That was it. And we didn't have a lot of records, so we listened deeply to what we had. And that's really that's kind of the case. And it's a big difference between then and now. Now we're it's almost a tidal wave of things to listen to. And then you really only had a couple of albums, and you did kind of. I mean, inadvertently study them and get to know every, you know, nook and cranny of them. So that was so interesting.
In some stories, I know William has said, he'll be telling me about some record that he grew up with, and he would say, oh, we wore that one out, literally, you know, from having listened to it so much. You know, records by Ben Webster and Duke Ellington and you know, many others. Yeah.
I think at some point he talks about maybe it was his dad and his friends. Sometimes we listen to the same record all day long.
Yeah, yeah.
maybe, you know, it's good for young people now to know that, because I think there was a lot of power in just getting to know a piece of music so intimately that you could, you know, recite it backwards practically. But let's talk a little bit about his early career and you told the story of him strapping his bass on his back, and I can't even imagine this, guys. For people that don't live in New York, walking from the South Bronx to the East Village, that's a long walk on a good day, right? You know, so to do that carrying a bass and to do it round trip, and I also have to say in that era, New York was wild in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Now it's sort of calm. I mean, well, now we're in a different phase, but for the longest time it was calm, and there were gaps. There are Gap stores everywhere, and everything just seemed very nice and normal. There was nothing abnormal about Manhattan and the Bronx in the 70s. Like, there wasn't a single neighborhood where you could. I mean, some were more dangerous than others, but there was no square inch of that region that you could walk down the street without having your radar on 360 and knowing what was going on. It was not safe. So to imagine this guy alone making – forget the distance, which is miles, right? I think it's miles.
Yeah, miles, yeah.
But also just the safety issue just boggles my mind. So let me ask you the question, Cisco. Why would he make such a journey – from the South Bronx to the East Village? What was going on in the East Village?
Yeah, I think he had some early encounters with some musicians by the early 70s that made him realize that I think the scene that he really wanted to be a part of was in the East Village. I think one of the most important early connections and the person that he still plays with to this day is the multi-instrumentalist Daniel Carter. They began playing in the early 70s, and I think... Yeah, I think Daniel is a kindred spirit, and I think they were both interested in, you know, they had similar interests, at least, or some related interests in the music. And so, you know, I think meeting a figure like that and becoming, you know, part of a community that was down there, I think is really what compelled William Parker to begin spending more time down in Manhattan and the Lower East Side, and what became known as the downtown scene. So, and I think that community was really, really enticing for him. I mean, he had been gigging in the Bronx a bit. I think it, you know, it was much more straight ahead types of gigs. He played played some interesting some shows there, but and he did lead a big band of his own in the Bronx, I think briefly. But I think with the opening of the Loft around 1972 or so, that's, you know, I think that was what he realized, like, okay, that's what I really want to do. So and he moved, you know, he began spending much more time down there. And then he eventually moved down there in 1975. But, you know, for a few years there, he was definitely commuting a lot. And, yeah, I mean, the Loft scene, I think it's sort of, you know, it's not, I think, has this sort of legendary kind of status because it allowed artists a lot of their own freedom. They didn't have to please the club owners. They didn't have to, you know, worry about whether they had a big crowd there or a small crowd. They didn't have to worry about all that. And it was self-produced. And I think it was also kind of coming out of that, it's, I think, part of the Black Arts movement of that era. And it sort of links to the Black Power movement in that I think there's a lot of sense of, like, the desire for autonomy, to have autonomous cultural spaces for people to be able to, you know, run their own, you know, not having to deal with club owners that might be trying to rip them off or something, and you know, running their own spaces, doing it in their own homes essentially, and oftentimes running their own record labels. You know, I think that was an empowering experience, and I think one that William has carried with him to this very day. In that, the strength of the community is what matters, and to take the reins of the production of your music as much as you can. And you know, to begin to kind of self-produce and get your music out there. So, I think all of those things were really enticing to him. And he spent a lot of time at a number of Lofts there. Studio Wee being a big one. Studio Rigby, of course, which is probably maybe the most well-known of all the Lofts, or one of them anyway. That was run by Sam Rivers, and you know, and others. So, I think those are, you know, I think the community was enticing, and he began to make music there. So, he began to get hired by people playing in the Lofts, and they weren't making very much money. I mean, he said, you know, if he made it, you know, if they made more than a few dollars or something for the night, you know, he could then maybe come back on the subway. But, a lot of times, people weren't necessarily making any money playing those loft gigs, but they were able to do what they wanted artistically. And I think that was really, really important.
One of the maps you have is of the some of the lofts and some of the key cultural spots in the East Village and also in Soho, in Public Theater, which was a very important place. Joseph Papp did an amazing thing. He sponsored and turned over the Public Theater to loft musicians to perform in that beautiful space. And of course, the Five Spot was very important, and Studio Wee and Ali's Alley, and even Ornette had a loft down there on Prince Street. So it was a big deal. Yeah, I actually got to experience the tail end of that. And yeah, it was exactly as Cisco describes. First of all, again, talking about New York then and New York now, New York then downtown was cheap. It's hard to imagine, but people would actually move to New York to get cheap rent. And the cheapest of the cheap rent was in the East Village, and believe it or not, Soho and Tribeca. And musicians could buy or rent huge spaces, big open formal industrial spaces. It was the garment district at one point, or making of clothing district. So you had these big light-filled rooms because they were built in the era of no electricity, right? And they also had very solid floors because they had these big looms and stuff on them. And so for pretty little money, you could have a 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 square foot space, and then people would turn them into performance places, and it was magic. It was really magic. And I guess the thing might be hard for people to imagine, but it's not always pleasant for musicians to have to deal with club owners. Not all club owners are nice or reasonable, and in fact, sometimes the opposite. So the idea of being able to do your own thing to your own standard. I don't know, Cisco, if you've ever read, I forget where I read this. I wish I knew the source. I can't even visualize it. But at one point, Cecil Taylor and I think Jimmy Lyons, might have been a account of Jimmy Lyon. They were threatened with violence by the club owner for playing their music. I mean, he wanted, like, it was sort of a lot of clubs were mafia run. They were mafia owned. Those guys wanted to make money, period. Mm-hmm. And they weren't terribly interested in advancing the art.
right.
And they also kind of, they're strangely, I mean, they're not strangely conservative. They're kind of conservative folks. They like the status quo. And they actually react quite negatively to anybody that challenges the status quo. So this idea, this ability to have your own space and do your own thing is not just, like a nice fluffy thing. It was kind of like a huge thing. So East Village playing down in lofts and in small clubs and in people's apartments and so on. And then what was sort of the next phase of his evolution as an artist?
Yeah. So first of all, I wanted to actually pick up on a theme that you, I think, almost began with, and that is you talked about the maps in the book and. One of the things I really tried to pay attention to in terms of detail was really, I was thinking, culture happens in a place. It doesn't just, it's not just put out on a record, or it's not, communities form, and they form around particular places. And I think, especially something like music, which is a communal art form, it's produced in very different ways from, say, a painting, which might be done by one person who's in a studio somewhere and is really isolated. Music has to, unless it's a solo artist, it's always created together with other people. These things form in certain places. And I think the community aspect is very different. I mean, even think about how music is presented as opposed to an art gallery. An art gallery, you can go there individually at any time, as long as it's open, and you can view it by yourself. Music is almost always created communally and also consumed communally. You go when everyone else is there, and you're all there at the same time. So I think is interesting, and I think the lofts were wonderful community spaces in that kind of sense. Clubs could also be okay at times, but I think you're right. I mean, a lot of the time, most club owners were not necessarily very interested in advancing the art form. They wanted to pack the house, and whatever it took to do that was the way that they would go. Most cutting edge art is not understood fully when it first comes out, when it's first created. So, I think that's almost true across the board. So, there is always this kind of like undertow of conservatism, I think, in a lot of music clubs in that way. That can sometimes prevent, or kind of hold the music back. Now for the next phase, he was playing in a lot of different settings in the loft scene and playing with a number of different groups. And he had the music ensemble that he had with Billy Bang and Daniel Carter and Roger Baird is an example of one of those bands. I think that was his first sort of regular band. They didn't make any money, but I think it was an open kind of space to create, in terms of, working with collaborators who are really open to stuff. And that band, I think, was pretty expansive in its scope. I mean, he would say, they would get together and it wasn't about, okay, we're going to play this piece right now. He said that, they would get together for hours at a time. They might spend a whole, 4, 5, 6 hours together. One of them might start playing something, or another person might be reading a book. A third person might get up and recite some poetry or whatever it was. And they were just kind of together and they're creating, and things came out of that, it's sort of very open, like whatever you're doing, as long as you're seeking something, it seemed to be how that group worked. And I think that was an important first sort of phase where it's the feeling of acceptance in this broader arts community, and the openness to kind of full exploration and not feeling like, oh, we need to arrive at our destination soon. Like it might take us years to find, what we're looking for. So I think that was an important early group. I mean, he also, he played with the Jamil Moondock's band, Ensemble Muntu. And I think that band, some people call it the greatest of the loft bands. It certainly was one of them. And that band was probably the first one that he played with that really gigged regularly for a while. And they, regularly in the lofts, and they put out a couple of records. So that constitutes some of William's earliest recorded work, along with a few other records that he made as a side person during those years. I don't know if we want to move a little bit further forward. I mean, I would say he had a couple of breaks, I would say. One, he got hired by Don Cherry to play at the Five Spot in 1975 for a week or two. And I think he said that was the first time he ever really made money off of the, playing. And it wasn't like he was making huge amounts of money, but he made, he was paid respectably at that time. And, just kind of getting that kind of respect and getting on the stages of some more well-known figures, Don Cherry being a significant figure in the music, I think an underappreciated figure even today, I think. An early innovator, played with Ornette Coleman and many others. I think that was one. But then, he got hired for one major gig by Cecil Taylor in 1974 where he played at Carnegie Hall. So it was possible to occasionally kind of vault yourself from, like, you're playing in the lofts, to playing on some of the sort of more well-known stages. That wasn't a money-making gig because it was a big band gig. So I think there were well over 20 people at that gig, I think, playing on that gig. So, but that, that opened him up to meeting a lot of other people. And I don't know, maybe that just planted the seed in the back of Cecil Taylor's mind in terms of, William's abilities on the bass. Because it was about 6 years later that that Cecil Taylor reached out and hired William for a gig in Blues Alley in Washington, D.C. And that one gig turned into a regular gig, and they played together for the next 11 years. So I think that's really William's big, big break in terms of being recognized by one of the masters and, the true visionaries of the music.
And to then be able to play with him regularly. I mean, they toured in all, you know, they toured around the United States. They played, you know, started playing all these festivals in Europe. So, yeah, I mean, the Cecil Taylor, you know, beginning to play with Cecil Taylor in 1980 and onwards through the 80s, all the way up to 1991. That was really fully transformational, I think, for William Parker.
You know, your account of that reminded me of an experience I had, and I have a feeling that here's what happened. So I was working at mm-hmm. India Navigation Records. You ever heard of that label?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was run by Bob Cummins, and he was an attorney for Western Union or something in the satellite division or something like that. It was something quite technical, and he used to go around to the lofts with his recording equipment and document performances, and then he created the label India Navigation. So in the fall of 1980, management, I sat in the office and answered the phone and, you know, did busy work, but I kind of was the guy. It sounds like a big deal, but it was just a room with a desk and files, you know, and a phone. Cecil Taylor had at that time a loft on Chambers Street, I believe, and it was being renovated, all right? So Bob said to Cecil, why don't you come over and use our studio? And Bob, we had a room with a piano. It wasn't really a studio, but so maybe you could help me place this in time. It must have been William Parker because, and I've told this story before, but I think this also kind of echoes something that you said that's really important. These guys didn't fool around. Like they, mm-hmm. like when they got together to work, they worked. like few people on earth work on anything. And so Cecil arrived by himself, and I kid you not, he played 3 solid hours, no break, just all out. And I always used to tell people this story, the drummer and the bass player arrived. I didn't know who they were. I never knew who they were. And maybe I'm realizing now it must have been William Parker. And then Cecil worked with them. Very little talk, by the way. That's wasn't a lot of conversation. And they worked together for about 3 hours. And then Jimmy Lyons arrived. And after 2 hours of that, I had to go home, you know. So and they showed no signs of, oh, we're wrapping it up. In other words, 8 hours into this, Cecil Taylor was still, just roaring. And the bass player, who I'm now guessing was William Parker, because he was young, and the drummer, they'd been there 6 hours, and it was just there was no end in sight. So if anybody thinks this music is, you know, casually produced, let me disabuse you of that notion. These guys work really, really, really hard. So the Cecil Taylor. That would have been William, right? This would have been December 1980, and they were getting ready for something. I imagine it must have been William Parker.
It quite possibly could be. I believe he started playing with them right around that time. It was late 1980. I can't confirm 100% because
sure.
I have to check with William, but it's quite possible that was. William Parker.
Do me a favor, if you would. Yeah. Ask him if he can remember rehearsing mm-hmm. with Cecil at the India Navigation studio in the Western Union building, and it really just would have been a pretty small room. It wasn't a big deal. I would love to know if that was William Parker.
I can check. I'll have to check on that. William often talked about playing with Cecil Taylor, and Cecil Taylor is so kind of famous for his dedication, his long rehearsals. I mean, you might have an 8-hour rehearsal with Cecil Taylor, and no one's leaving that room until it's done. So, he was kind of famous for that. So, and I think those kinds of rehearsals and those experiences, I think, just deepened the music for people. I mean, William always said, William's a master of metaphors, and he used to always say one of the things he learned from Cecil Taylor is, well, first of all, I remember when he first looked at some of Cecil's charts, he said it looked like Cecil was playing all the parts, you know. So like Cecil was doing so much of music, and like where was he going to fit? And then, you know, he said he kind of had to really kind of learn how to fit within, you know, and kind of work with what Cecil Taylor was doing. But then I remember he said the big thing he said is he said, you know, when you think about the music, there are different layers of the music. And he said he always referred to the bass as the basement of the music. It's like the deepest part. So he said, no matter how deep you are, there's another level deeper, and you have to keep finding that deeper and deeper level. And he said that's what he learned with Cecil, because you would play, you're playing together for hours and hours and hours, and it makes you push deeper into something. You know, like, you know, and you can think maybe for a second, like, oh, you know, this is, I'm locked in, this is as, you know, good as it gets. And you think, no, there's always something more. So, yeah, he said that's one of the things that he really learned from Cecil Taylor, which I thought was interesting. It definitely, I think, pushed him to dig into himself and find what he could find.
That makes so much sense. It was like an excavation process, you know, just digging and digging and digging. And I can tell people, I also had the opportunity to watch Renette Coleman rehearse Primetime. And that was also an all day event. I arrived at noon and they had already been there all morning. And then they just went on and on and on. And again, there wasn't a lot of talk. There was a whole lot of playing and a whole lot of listening, but not a whole lot of talk. Hey, let's talk about, because William gives a lot of thought to music education, and he actually wrote, and this is, this book is a must for music educators. I should have said that at the very beginning of this interview, but I'll say it now. If you're teaching music, you must have this book, and you must see this life, which is so beautifully detailed in this book. But one of the things that's in the book is William's Blueprint for a Music School. It's fascinating, just fascinating.
I think from his own experience, I think there were things that he enjoyed, you know, that he experienced from a place like Jazz Mobile. But I think there were things that he wished he had been able to experience and just never did on an educational level. So in terms of the way that music is taught, so you know, the embracing of improvisation, the embracing of personal voice, the importance of all that, developing one's own sound, which is such a big part of the music. I think this is a broader conversation that we could have, because I think, you know, I've certainly talked with many musicians involved in music, you know, that I think have relatable experiences where they felt, instead of feeling fostered and encouraged to kind of grow in certain, you know, music educational settings, that, you know, they felt stifled or they felt ignored or they felt kind of suppressed, you know, sometimes in terms of developing their own sound, as opposed to, you know, I don't know, imitating Charlie Parker or whoever it is that people are sort of holding up on these pedestals as the thing to shoot for. So, yeah, I think William had other ideas, and I think his blueprint is very interesting. I'm glad that we were able to put that in the book.
Oh, it's so important. And speaking of Ornette Coleman, he was thrown out of his high school band for playing bebop. I mean, there you go. I guess it's the tension between the understandable need for a degree of regimentation. In other words, I mean, at a certain point, the subway has to run on time and, you know, things have to be kind of organized. But you can go too far and actually, especially in the creative environment, and actually, you know, suppress people. And I think musicians feel that most acutely. Which raises this really interesting thing. You quote William talking about what music really is, that it's a natural force. It's something that musicians tap into, not something that's necessarily manufactured. And so if that suggests that the musician's job is to be receptive to whatever those forces are. Therefore, if somebody's telling you can't play this or don't play it like that, it's kind of an obstacle. Well, great. Well, Cisco, I want to thank you so much for writing this book, and I want to say who I think this book would most be for. Obviously, if you're anybody interested in the loft scene and free jazz and so-called avant-garde jazz, this book is a must. I don't know many books on the subject that I think so highly. I mean, there's some good stuff out there for sure, but this one really, really stands out. So if you're interested in that chapter of jazz history, you have to have this book. I would also say for music educators, there are stories in here to inspire young musicians, I think. The fact that somebody maybe playing with a pawn shop bass and not getting many formal lessons and having to figure it out yourself. I think this can be really inspiring to people that want to learn music. I would also say to aspiring musicians, this is a model. You know, William Parker's a model of dedication. So if you want to see how far dedication can go, this is a testament to that. And then I would really say to anybody that loves the music and is curious about, well, how do these great musicians come to be? William's story is unique, of course, but it's not uncommon. I mean, Ornette spent endless hours as a kid sorting it all out, listening to Charlie Parker records. And this is the story of every musician that really excels and changes the world. It's a level of dedication that we can hardly imagine. That's why I love your book, Cisco, because you actually document the nuts and bolts and every step of the way of how he went from a child just hearing music and kind of digging it and to being this really creative force.
One thing, just to interject, one of the amazing things, I worked very closely with William Parker to write this book, and William has an unbelievably detailed memory. So much of that detail, I think, came directly from William, and it wouldn't have been possible to write this without his deep involvement. So, I was always amazed at how much he remembered, even from things that happened 45 or 50 years ago. So, just wanted to say that.
I'm glad you did, because I was wondering about your research. I was like, this guy's a research savant. He must have dug through every scrap of paper and every oral history. And because, again, this book is like you really get the full scope of William Parker's life. I mean, it seems like hardly any creative step in his life is missing from this. It's all there. It's all there.
We did try to leave no stone unturned. I looked at his writings. I looked at basically journal entries that he had from long ago, all of the liner notes that he'd ever written. I tried to look at reviews that people had done of his work and, other things that other people had written. So, I tried to
use every resource available because, so much of music, I always think of that quote from Eric Dolphy where he says, I'm not going to quote it perfectly here, but once music is over, it's kind of, it's gone. It just hangs in the air for a second and then it's gone. And I think the history of the music is actually quite difficult sometimes to put together because, when one gig is done, people are moving on to the next gig and oftentimes information about these things is lost. It's just not really well recorded. So, trying to dig all this up and put it together, it was a pretty monumental challenge, but it definitely was an incredibly interesting journey for me.
Well, you surely did it, and this is really a model. I wish we had similar biographies for every great musician, and luckily William is alive, and you were able to talk with him, and fill in details and elaborate, but. This is a standard and a model for how to do the biography of a musician.
Thank you.
So the book is called. You're very welcome. Thank you, really. I had high hopes for the book when I got it, but then when I was reading, I was like, oh my God, this is great. So the book is called Universal Tonality, The Life and Music of William Parker. The author is Cisco Bradley. And all praise to Duke University Press for bringing, because that's the next link in the chain. We need publishers to be willing to invest in documenting this, in distributing books like this. So Duke University Press did it, and thank you to Duke University Press for helping bring this book into reality. Well, Cisco, thanks again for writing the book, for giving us some time to, hear about how it got put together and some of the elements of it. And I cannot encourage this book too strongly for people to read it who love jazz. And I really do think for educators and aspiring artists, this is a must. You'll learn a lot about William Parker, but you'll also learn a lot about how greatness comes into being. There was this great saying, maybe we'll end on this. Miles Davis was being interviewed, and it was sort of banter back and forth, and at one point he looked at the camera and he said, "I'm no accident." In other words, this just didn't fall off a tree. Some human being made tremendous dedication to achieving this kind of music. So, Cisco, thanks. Great to meet you, and thanks for the book.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Ken.
Great. And the book again, Universal Tonality, The Life and Music of William Parker by Cisco Bradley, published by Duke University Press. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.